known flight paths taken by Chinese anti-submarine aircraft, while a row of overlapping circles tinted red told them there were no breaks to exploit in the line of sonar buoys. "They're not messing around," she said. "This level of security confirms that they're hiding something down there," Paul replied. "But trying to sneak past all of that is a wasted effort. We might as well send them an email announcing our arrival and make our own reservations at the Shanghai jail."
"Much as I'd like to disagree with you," she began.
Her voice trailed off. She wondered if there was another way. Maybe they didn't have to cross from Japan. Maybe they could come in from the south. She expanded the map and discovered additional naval patrols in that direction. The Chinese had left nothing to chance. Then she noticed something else.
What about the shipping lane?
What about it? Shanghai is one of the busiest ports in Asia. If we could book passage aboard a freighter, and then jump overboard for a leisurely swim when we're halfway there?
Not us personally, she replied. But suppose we dropped something overboard. Something with cameras, sonar, and a remote hookup that could be controlled from the ship.
Paul brightened noticeably. We'd have to leave it down there.
A small price to pay, she replied.
Good point, Paul said. But we still have the matter of getting passage on a freighter to China at the last minute, which might raise a few eyebrows, and then sneaking a rather bulky ROV on board without anyone checking our luggage, not to mention dropping it over the side without the crew getting suspicious.
Not if we are booking passage on the Osaka to Shanghai ferry.
She turned the computer his way, the dashed line of the shipping route highlighted on the screen. If this is correct, the ferry travels within 5 miles of the target area.
That solves the first problem, Paul said. What about the ROV?
Gamay drummed her fingers.
I'm still working on that.
A grin crossed Paul's face. I think I have the answer, Paul said. When does that ferry leave?
Gamay linked up to the internet and checked the schedule.
It's twice weekly. The next run departs at noon tomorrow.
I think that will give us just enough time, Paul said.
For what?
You ever hear of the remora?
The fish? She replied.
Yes, I'm well aware of it.
Not the fish, Paul said. The Joe Zavala mechanical creation inspired by the fish. One of our newest ROVs.
Gamay shook her head. She had a hard time keeping up with Joe's unending line of aquatic machines, but based on the name, she could imagine how this one worked.
The remora? Sounds interesting.
Last I heard, it was being tested in Hawaii, Paul said. If they haven't boxed it up and shipped it back stateside, Rudy can send it to us on the next flight. That should give us just enough time to buy our tickets and attach our little stowaway.
Chapter 13 Hashima Island, off the coast of Nagasaki. The room was sterile, cold, and well lit. At the center, a headless body lay on a metal table. Male, 6 feet tall, a Chinese technician said. The technician wore a white lab coat, glasses, and sported a shaved head. His name was Gao Jin, but he went by Gao. He was Walter Hahn's most accomplished engineer. Skin tone, Caucasian, Gao added. Obviously, we have no face or hair yet. Walter Hahn crouched to inspect the body. An odor of burned plastic came off the skin, which sported an oily appearance.
You need to run the production again, he said. There are imperfections. The wrong kind of imperfections.
Gao didn't argue. He wouldn't, of course, since he worked for Hahn. But the look on his face suggested he wasn't happy.
The body panels are very complex, he insisted. They have to move and flex like true skin and muscle. Even with the 3D printing process and the new polymers, it's very difficult to achieve a realistic, lifelike surface.
Levels of difficulty do not concern me, Hahn said. A blind man could tell that this skin is artificial. The smell alone would give it away. But should one get close enough to actually touch it, He would feel that the arms, legs, and torso are hairless, that the body has not a single mole, freckle, or scar.
We hadn't thought about that, Gao said.
Think about it now, Han ordered. Redesign the skin. Imagine it as an artist would. It should not be perfect. It should have creases where the elbow folds, occasional marks from age or damage. And unless we are modeling someone with a rare genetic condition, the body should have follicles.
Gao nodded, making notes.
I understand.
We will, and while you're at it, do something about the scent. It smells like a tire store in here.
Gao looked appropriately cowed.
Yes, sir. We'll get to work immediately.
Good, Han said. What about scalability? Can we produce different body sizes and shapes?
The layers of artificial skin and muscle rest on an inner frame, Gao explained. Unlike the factory models, these frames can be adjusted for any height and weight combination, ranging from 4 feet 8 inches up to 7 feet tall. Once the frame is built, we use the 3D printing process to make the body panels. We can even use one chassis repeatedly, bringing it in for adjustments and new body panels, changing the head and the length of the limbs and torso.
Excellent, Han said. Get to work. I'll be back tomorrow to check on the improvements.
Satisfied with Gao's newfound sense of urgency, Han moved to the door, pulled it open, and walked through. In one quick step, he went from the bright confines of the laboratory, with its smooth, clean walls, to a rough-cut tunnel carved from dirty stone. The passageway was dark, lit only by a few harsh LEDs along one wall. They gave off a pure white glow, but the dingy walls were wet with condensation, and they drank the light where it landed. Han moved slowly to avoid striking his head on a low point or tripping over a spot of uneven ground. He traveled onward and upward, passing through larger man-made chambers and then stepping out into an open area filled with natural light. He emerged from the tunnel not in the outside world, but in a vast empty warehouse. Corrugated metal walls rose up around him. Dusky light streamed in through windows high above, half of them cracked and broken, the rest covered with years of caked-on grime. A stack of old wooden pilings lay unused in one section, while a rusted three-wheeled bicycle, that obviously hadn't moved in years, sat abandoned in another. His arrival startled two pigeons. They launched themselves from the rafters high above, the sound of their flapping wings strangely loud in the open room. Han watched them fly around in a circle and settle onto a new perch. According to the technicians, the birds had found their way in several days ago and had yet to find their way out. Han felt the same way about the mission he had undertaken. At each turn, it seemed more like a self-created trap. He'd jumped at the chance to act as Wen's vanguard, but things had grown instantly more complicated. As he made his way toward the exit, his phone buzzed. He reached into his jacket pocket and pulled the slim black device out. No number appeared on the screen, just a code word indicating it was an encrypted call from another phone on his personal network. He pressed the green button and took the call.
"Where have you been?" a voice asked him bluntly. "I've called you 10 times this morning."
"The demon doesn't sound quite himself," Han thought. "My whereabouts are none of your concern. Why are you calling me?"
"To get what you owe me."
"You know the deal," Han said. "First, I have to confirm that your effort was successful. Until then..."
"I'm sending you a link," Ushioni said. "It will tell you what you need to know."
The phone chirped as the link arrived. Han held the phone out to watch. It was a Japanese news report, indicating that the death toll from the blaze at the castle was now up to 11, including 3 of the 4 Americans and the castle's owner, Kenzo. Several others were still in critical condition and not expected to survive. On the video, the reporter was standing outside the hospital, explaining that the cause of the fire was under investigation, but that there was little information to go on.
"You should pay me extra for such a job."
Ushioni wheezed as he spoke and went into a short coughing fit as soon as he finished.
"Are you ill?" Han asked. I was injured, Ushioni said, but I've done my job. Now it's your turn. I want my money.
Han wondered how badly the demon was hurt. Perhaps the fumes had burned his lungs as well.
You'll be paid what I promised, but I'll have to double-check this information. Do whatever you have to, Ushioni said, but I'm not waiting. There were survivors. I need to disappear in case the truth comes out. I want that money tonight.
I have other things to do, Han said.
Don't think you can cheat me, the demon snapped. Better men than you have died trying.
The last thing Han wanted on his hands was an angry, jaded assassin. The money itself was meaningless, but the principle mattered. I'll pay you tonight. I may even have another job for you, if you're up to it.
Silence for a second, then payment first. After that, we can talk.
Of course, Han said. I'll send you a location where the money will be distributed. You'll have to dress for the occasion.
I'm not coming to you.
Neutral ground, Han insisted. The Cento. Trust me, you'll see plenty of your old friends there.
Cento was a form of the verb meaning to fight, but it was also the name of an illegal club and gambling palace. Casinos weren't allowed in Japan. That didn't mean they were non-existent.
Fine, Ushioni said. I'll meet you there. No tricks.
Han wouldn't need any. The Cento was an upscale place, hidden on the outskirts of Tokyo. It was frequented by high rollers, the young rich who wanted a thrill, criminals who exuded class, and the occasional politician. It was run by one of the prominent Yakuza cartels, and there would certainly be other gangsters among the crowd, but none of them would have any connection to or love lost for Ushioni. Their only concern was that nothing disrupt their business, and to that end, they employed a large force of armed men and other security measures. All who entered were searched for weapons and wires. In Han's opinion, that made it the safest place on the entire island to finish his business with the demon.
Chapter 14. Osaka Bay. Paul stared straight ahead. Clad in a black wetsuit and a full-face helmet, he gripped the frame of the remora and held tight. It felt like he was riding a toboggan down a snow-covered mountain in a stiff headwind. His hands were clenched around the two metal bars that extended from the body of the machine. His feet were wedged into a space just ahead of the propulsion duct. The propeller, shrouded by a circular fairing, lay just beyond.
"Keep the speed down," Paul said, speaking into the microphone in his helmet. "One slip and I'll be looking for new toes."
The signal was relayed to the surface, where a repeater sent it on to Gamay, who was controlling the ROV from a boat 100 yards off. Her reply came over the intercom with a bit of interference.
"You insisted on going down there. Next time, I'll let you win that argument."
Keeping himself close to the body of the ROV, Paul risked a glance to the side. Off in the distance, through the murky waters of Osaka Bay, he could just make out the wake of Gamay's boat, a white slash against a dark background. Though he was only traveling at a depth of 60 feet, the surface was a dim shadow above him. Heavy ship traffic churned up sediment in the harbor, while runoff from the urban areas and industrial pollution caused algae to bloom and chased off the fish that ate it.
"I can barely see a thing," he said. "How far out are we?"
"Quarter mile to go," she said. "I'll have to start veering away from the ferry in a moment, but I'll lead you right toward the center of the hull. Let me know as soon as you catch sight of it. From that point on, I'll adjust course based on your instructions."
"You mean I get to tell you how to drive?" Paul asked. "This is a first."
"Don't get used to it," she replied. "Turning now. You should see the hull any minute." Braced against the buffeting force of the water and counting off the seconds, Paul kept his head up and eyes forward. While he saw nothing but a gray-green background, there was plenty to hear. The high-pitched electric whine of the Remora's battery-powered propeller, the fading buzz of Gemme's boat as it moved farther away, and a low hum that came from directly in front of him. "I can hear the ferry's engines," he said. "Can you see it?"
"Not yet," he replied, "but it's suddenly obvious to me why dolphins developed sonar."
"Sound works much better down there," she replied. "Let me know when you see something. I'm dialing back your speed."
Paul felt the ROV slow, and though they were doing only a couple of knots to begin with, it significantly reduced the strain on his arms. He caught sight of a shape up ahead.
"I see it," he said. "Looks like they're dumping bilge water. Steer me 10 degrees to the left, would you? I'd rather not go directly under that."
The shrouded propeller deflected to the side, and the tadpole-shaped ROV turned.
"Perfect," Paul said. "Straight ahead now for 20 seconds. Then bring me up to a depth of 30 feet and cut the throttle."
The hull of the ferry came into focus. The ship was a 20-year veteran of channel crossings. Its metal plating was painted red beneath the waterline, but the rust and a coating of marine growth gave it a mottled color. It drew 16 feet of water, and Paul passed beneath the outside edge with plenty of headroom above him.
"Cut the throttle," he said.
The motor shut down right on cue, and Paul and the Remora coasted to a stop, dead center beneath the keel of the ship. Paul switched on a diving light.
"And now for the manual portion of our endeavor."
With a tether from the Remora attached to his ankle, Paul released his grip on the ROV and swam upward toward the overhanging hull. Diving beneath a large ship was an interesting experience, one Paul hadn't had before. Reaching out to the hull felt as if he was touching the bottom of a cloud.
"Contact," he said.
"How's it feel to have 30,000 tons floating over your head?" Gamay asked.
"Makes me thankful for the laws of buoyancy. I'd be very upset if they were repealed in the next 10 minutes.
Moving along the hull, Paul found the spot he was looking for, a section near the bow that the engineers at Numa insisted would have the lowest amount of dynamic pressure once the ferry began to move.
"I've found the attachment site."
"How's it look?" Gamay asked.
"It's a full-on barnacle convention," Paul said. "Apparently the Shanghai Ferry Company doesn't care to defoul their ships."
This layer of marine life was the reason for Paul's ride on the Remora. The ROV was designed to connect magnetically to the bottom of any steel-hulled vessel, but it couldn't attach securely through a layer of hard-shelled barnacles. To ensure that it stayed in place until they were ready to use it, Paul would have to scrape a section of the hull clean. To do so required a device known as a needle scaler. The electrically powered appliance was shaped like an assault rifle, complete with a shoulder stock, a vertical hand grip, and a long barrel that ended in a titanium chisel. Once Paul activated the scaler, the chisel would vibrate back and forth at high speed. Paul would be the manpower behind it, pushing the blade through the barnacles, scraping them away, and revealing smooth metal beneath.
"Here goes," he said.
He switched the unit on, and it shuddered to life. Making sure he had good contact, Paul pressed the blade against the hull and shoved it forward. He had to kick with his legs to keep from being pushed back, but the scaler worked like magic, and the barnacles fell away one strip at a time. Gamay began talking.
"How thick are the layers?"
"At least 4 inches deep," Paul said.
"It's amazing how fast marine growth appears on a ship," she told him. "Did you know that newly launched vessels have a film of microbes on them within 24 hours of going into the water?"
"Did not know that," Paul said. "Trust me, these are not microbes."
As Paul worked, Gamay launched into a soliloquy on the subject of barnacles. She spoke about the Romans using lead sheets to protect their boats from woodworms, and the British putting copper on the hulls of their sailing fleet. She said something about tin being a great defense against marine growth, but unfortunately, that was because it releases poison into the water at an alarming rate. Paul wasn't really paying attention. He was concentrating on keeping the chisel at the proper angle and forcing it through the colony of hard-shelled organisms. He cleared a 2-foot by 2-foot patch in one spot, a smaller section 10 feet behind the first, and finally, a third spot just ahead of the main one. By the time he finished, he was getting quite good at the task.
"In fact, the process of marine fouling is really quite fascinating," Gamay finished.
I'm sure it is, Paul said, certain that he couldn't repeat a third of what she'd said. And the defouling process is surprisingly gratifying, like using a snowblower on the sidewalk back in Maine.
Are you finished already?
All set. He clipped the scaler to his belt. I'm going to maneuver the remora into position. Stand by to activate magnets. Manually guiding the remora in the still waters of the harbor was another athletic endeavor. The ROV was set to zero buoyancy, which meant it weighed nothing, but it still had enough inertia that Paul was breathing hard by the time he'd pushed, pulled, and otherwise manhandled the ROV into place. Activate the main magnet. Holding the remora steady, he felt a buzz and then a solid clunk as it pulled itself up a few inches and attached itself to the hull. The main magnet was a large circular patch on the top of the remora's head, just like the suction cup on the actual fish. Activate the other two, Paul called out. The fore and aft magnets powered up and connected, locking the ROV in place. Paul tested it by grabbing onto the rigging, placing his feet against the ship's hull and pulling with all his might. The ROV didn't budge. Letting go, he drifted away from the hull. One large metal barnacle attached where the others were scraped off, he said, heading your way. Fantastic, Gamay said. I'm 200 yards off the port beam, directly across from you. Swim perpendicular to the hull and you'll find me without any problem. Better not dawdle, though. We still have a ferry to catch. Chapter 15. Outskirts of Tokyo Metro Area. The sun had already dropped below the horizon when the gleaming Bentley Mulsanne left the highway and drove onto a narrow road that led out of Tokyo and into the countryside. An ultra-lux sedan, with 500 horsepower, the Mulsanne was the latest flagship from the famed British automaker. It was large, especially by Japanese standards, with a bulky shape softened by streamlined edges. The design conveyed a sense of speed, power, and the possibility that DNA from an Abrams battle tank was hidden beneath all the luxurious touches. Kurt and Joe sat in the back of the $300,000 car. My first house was smaller than this, Kurt said, admiring the spacious cabin. Probably cost a lot less, too, Joe added. The ride was crisp, smooth, and silent enough to be a sensory deprivation chamber. The cabin was appointed with cream-colored leather, offset by mahogany trim. The seats were perfectly designed to cradle the occupants. When Kurt tilted his seat back, a footrest extended from below, supporting his legs. Joe copied him, putting his hands behind his head for good measure. Too bad we only travel like this when we're undercover and headed toward our probable doom. Superintendent Nagano had learned from an informant that a large payoff was about to take place within the confines of an illegal casino on the outskirts of Tokyo. His informant wasn't sure if the payment would go to Ushione or not, but the timing and the location were correct. Using other contacts, he'd arranged for Kurt and Joe to enter the casino, posing as wealthy Americans. That was the easy part. The hard part would come when they tried to place a tracking device on the demon if they saw him. If anyone gets suspicious, we won't make it out of there alive, Kurt warned.
At least we'll look good in our caskets, Joe said.
Kurt laughed at that. Joe was dressed in a sharply cut Armani suit. It had narrow lapels, was made of silk, and fit his athletic build perfectly. Beneath the crisp black jacket, he wore a maroon dress shirt, and, for added effect, he'd shaved 3 days of stubble into a thin Van Dyke beard. It gave him a slightly devilish look. If you end up in the netherworld, they're going to mistake you for management.
All part of my plan, Joe said, just in case I haven't been as good as I think I have. You, on the other hand, are going to be mistaken for the Mater D.
Kurt smiled and took the comment without rebuttal. He was dressed in a double-breasted white dinner jacket with a silk shawl collar, a crisp white shirt, and a trim bow tie. Shades of Bogart in Casablanca. Unlike Joe, he was clean-shaven, though he'd let his sideburns grow down a bit and had dyed his silver hair black to make it less likely he'd be recognized. How far to the Cento? Superintendent Nagano, dressed as a chauffeur, glanced back at them from the driver's seat.
No more than 5 minutes. Enough time for me to ask once again whether you want to risk this.
It's the only way, Kurt said. Joe nodded his agreement. Nagano turned his gaze back to the road ahead.
You understand, once you're inside, I cannot assist you. For obvious reasons, the police cannot raid this establishment without causing a bloodbath.
I'm not expecting any violence, Kurt said. If the place is run as tightly as you suggest, Ushione won't be armed.
He can kill without firearms or knives, Nagano said. He can kill with his bare hands or with 100 different everyday objects. Death is an art form to him. Be extremely careful that he doesn't see you place the tracking device.
Kurt nodded. In his pocket were 2 coins. Inside each lay a sophisticated beacon. Joe was carrying 2 similar coins. The plan was to slip 1 into the pocket of the demon, and another into the pocket of whoever paid him off, track them once they left the building, and take them down outside the gambling palace. Whoever found themselves in closest proximity to the targets would make the attempt. Knowing that Ushione had fought Joe face to face already and might easily recognize him, Kurt intended to make sure he would get there first.
We'll be careful, Kurt said. Anything else we should know? Only that things should go smoothly up front, Nagano said. My informant has placed you on the list. They will know Joe as a boxing promoter from Las Vegas. You are listed as a hedge fund manager with ties to Joe's company. Websites, addresses, and other background details have been arranged just in case anyone checks. I suspect the owners will be interested in getting you both to the tables. Reputations for betting and losing large sums have been established.
At least that part is accurate, Kurt joked. He felt the billfold in his pocket. They each carried over 1,000,000 yen, a little more than $10,000, but that was just for starters. Once they burned through their cash, the Cento's staff would access accounts set up in their names and give them markers for 10 times that amount.
Where are we most likely to find Ushione? Kurt asked.
Impossible to say. But he's the type that appreciates brutality. Look for him in the viewing stands of the combat arena.
Boxing isn't necessarily brutality, Joe pointed out. There will be only 1 boxing match, Nagano said. 5 rounds. It's just a prelude. Bloodier combat will follow. I regret that you might see someone die on the floor in there. You will have to allow it, or your cover will be destroyed.
Fights to the death, Kurt said.
Not necessarily, Nagano told them, but using weapons that can easily kill. Knives, swords, chains. Deadly combat, most often performed by those in the organization who have disgraced themselves. It is a chance for them to prove themselves worthy. But for those who fail, let me just say, what you're about to witness isn't for the faint of heart.
They spent the next 2 minutes in silence, driving the last quarter mile beside a 12-foot fence of iron bars that sprouted from a formidable brick wall. Finally, they arrived at a massive front gate. Armed men dressed in suits checked their credentials, searched beneath the car with mirrors, and led 2 dogs around the outside to sniff for explosives. When the car was cleared, they were allowed to pull through. A long driveway led up through ornate gardens. Brightly flowering shrubs, ornamental lanterns, and cherry trees filled with blossoms lined the path. As they neared the building, they drove across a decorative wooden bridge that spanned a tranquil koi pond. The traditional cues vanished as they reached the main building, which was of modern design with a facade made up of tinted glass. It rose 2 stories and was capped by a layer of smooth concrete. There was a definite curve to the structure, and both sides vanished into hills covered in thick grass.
Postmodern bomb shelter, Kurt said, voicing the first thought that came to mind.
More like an ultra-efficient building designed to take advantage of the Earth's temperature-regulating properties, Joe said.
You are an optimist, Kurt said.
What you're looking at is only the top level, Nagano said.
This structure is designed like a stadium, circular and with a hollow interior, but instead of rising above ground, it punches down into it. Kurt had seen aerial photos taken before the building was finished. Behind the hills lay a natural depression. The hills and the man-made structure enclosed it and covered it. While it was technically a hotel, lodging was offered only on the upper level. Farther down, one could find the darker parts of the operation: gambling, prostitution, and drugs. At the bottom lay the combat arena that acted as the main attraction, visible through glass walls from everywhere else in the building. The Bentley slowed as they approached the entry door. A valet walked up to them, but Nagano waved him off and parked just beyond the entry. "Wish us good luck," Kurt said. "You have the coins for that," Nagano replied as he opened the door. Kurt stepped from the car, buttoned his jacket, and waited for Joe. As Nagano got back in the car and drove off, they walked up the steps and into a lobby as elegant as that in any five-star hotel. Marble floors, crystal chandeliers, and modern furniture were arranged in the open space that curved around in both directions. A pianist, with a violinist accompanying him, played quietly in one section of the lobby, while tall women in daring dresses moved here and there, carrying silver trays covered with champagne flutes. "Nice place," Kurt said. "Can't believe you're my date this evening." Joe adjusted his cuffs. "How do you think I feel?" They were ushered through security, where their phones were confiscated and placed in small lockers. Each of them was given a key. A body scan came next, using a wand similar to those at the airport. It beeped repeatedly at Kurt's side. He pulled out the transmitters, holding them out for the security guard to see. The man grinned. The 5-yen coin, with its distinctive yellowish tint and small hole in the center, was considered good luck all across Japan. The guard had seen these coins before. Many gamblers carried them. "For luck," Kurt said, offering one to the guard. The man refused, and the coins went back into Kurt's pocket. Finished with the security check, Kurt made a straight line to the nearest hostess. He took a champagne glass from the tray, smiled at the woman, and glanced around. Joe met him a moment later. "Pretty good crowd. I heard the Colosseum used to pack them in, too." "Split up?" Kurt nodded. "I'll go this way," he said, pointing. "Let's make a few laps and check out the levels. Look for exits in case we need them. If we don't bump into each other in an hour, let's meet back here by the piano. Feel free to blow through some of that money. The faster we go into debt, the quicker we'll get front row seats to the fight." Joe scanned the crowd. "I think I'll mingle as I toss the cash around. These look like the type of women who appreciate a large expense account." Kurt tipped his glass to Joe and let him wander. After a final scan of the lobby, he turned in the other direction. Kurt moved slowly, without any sign of haste, one hand holding the champagne flute, the other in his pocket, fingers on the lucky coins. Joe wandered the ring-shaped building, studying the faces that passed while he pretended to look at the art on the walls. Though he'd given Kurt the best description he could, Joe was the only one who'd seen Ushione up close, and that meant Joe was far more likely to spot the man they were looking for than Kurt. He made a circuit of the upper level, moved to the inner wall, and gazed through the floor-to-ceiling glass. Down below, at least 4 stories beneath him, lay the combat arena. Circular instead of square, it was partially obscured by a bank of floodlights suspended from a metal rigging, secured to the walls by guide wires and a catwalk. The lights were off at the moment, and the arena was empty, as were the seats around it. For the time being, he'd have to look elsewhere for Ushione. Kurt was on his second glass of champagne by the time he reached the casino level. He'd yet to spot anything resembling a feverish hitman, nor had he spent a single yen of the money given to him by the Japanese Federal Police. It was time to change that. He passed several high-stakes blackjack tables, looked in on a craps game, where the players were stacked 3 deep,
and then wandered through an aisle packed with old-fashioned machines that were clanking and clunking as heavy silver balls bounced around inside them, and neon flashed and flickered in pulsating frenzy. Patrons stared at the machines as if the mysteries of the universe would be found within, taking no notice of Kurt as he examined their faces.
"Pachinko," a voice suggested. Kurt turned. A seductively dressed hostess was motioning toward an open machine.
"Arigato," Kurt said. "Not right now." He passed through the pachinko hall and took a seat at one of the Paigao poker tables. Passing over his million yen, he was given a stack of clear chips and slid most of them into place right off the bat. The cards came out with incredible speed.
9, the dealer said, looking at Kurt. A few more cards were dealt, and she pushed a stack of chips next to his.
Kurt smiled, left all the chips on the table, and waited for the next hand. He received another natural 9, the highest and unbeatable score. The dealer had an 8 and lost by 1. The stack of chips doubled again. Feeling he was on a hot streak, despite the plan to lose money fast, he moved his bet, placing all of it on the dealer instead. Essentially, he was betting against himself. This time he ended up with a 4 and the dealer had 7. Technically, the dealer won, but Kurt got paid. The huge stacks of chips were doubled again and then pushed back toward him.
"Table limit," the dealer said.
In 3 hands, he'd grown his stack to 8 million yen. Kurt looked at the winnings. This would never happen if it was my own money. He decided to bet lower amounts until his luck changed for the worse, tipped the dealer handsomely, and pushed a few chips into place. As the next set of cards came out, he felt someone slide up behind him. A hand with perfectly manicured fingernails slid softly onto his shoulder. He turned to see the attendant from the pachinko lounge. She'd followed him to the table.
"You are lucky," she said.
Kurt grinned. He must have been doing well if the shills were already gathering. "So far," he replied. He didn't shoo the woman away. Her presence would help him blend in, and her beauty would draw eyes toward her instead of him. It would make looking around the room easier and less dangerous. The next hand was a loser, something Kurt was thankful for. But he'd made a small fortune already and would have to lose a lot more before he could ask for credit. He bet again and continued scanning the room for any sign of Ushioni. At first, nothing caught his eye. Then, at a table across from him, partially blocked by the pit boss, he noticed a familiar face. He focused through the smoke, squinting just to be sure.
"You win again, sir," the dealer said.
"Damn," Kurt whispered, reacting not to the latest unwanted victory, but to a face he hadn't expected to see. Sitting at the table across the pit was Master Kenzo's missing acolyte, Akiko. She was dressed elegantly, heavily made up, and smoking a long, thin cigarette, while her gaze flicked from the cards in front of her to every corner of the casino floor. Kurt could imagine several reasons she might have chosen to be here, and none of them were good.
Chapter 16. The Sento. Walter Hahn stood in a private suite on the upper level of the Sento. He gazed briefly out through the floor-to-ceiling glass. From this vantage point, he could see the lower levels of the circular building. The crowd was gathering, and even he wanted to see the combat, but business took precedence. He turned his attention back to the guest in his suite, Ushioni. The demon didn't quite look himself.
"Are you all right, my friend? Or is this all part of your disguise?"
"Recovering from my wounds," Oni replied. "All the more reason for the payment to be quick."
As Oni spoke, a twitch ran across his face. It looked like he was snarling. With the facial tics, a yellowish tint discoloring his eyes, and a gloss of moisture on his skin, Oni was beginning to look like his namesake.
"You will be paid," Han said. "But first, I give you a choice. Payment for the job you've completed. or 10 times that amount for an easier, but more important task.
I've had enough of your jobs, the demon said. The last easy task nearly got me killed. Now pay me so I can leave.
Leaving won't help you this time, Hans said.
What are you talking about?
The federal police have your description at long last, Hans said. They know what you look like, and they will find you soon enough. When they do, they'll hang plenty of crimes on you, most of which you're actually guilty of.
You gave them my...
Why would I do that if I still want your help?
Then how?
You said yourself there were survivors. Oni's face turned a new shade, anger and sickness mixed. Han continued,
If you want to live out your days in anything but wretched poverty and constant hiding, you'll need more than just a modicum of wealth. You'll need a new life, a new identity, and enough money to last an eternity.
From his pocket, Han pulled a folded sheet of paper. Holding it between two fingers, he offered it to Oni, who hesitated, and then snatched it away. Oni unfolded the paper to see an incredibly accurate drawing of his face, right down to the fishhook-shaped scar on his lip. Below the drawing was a diagram of his tattoos. It was also surprisingly accurate. Boiling with rage, he ripped the paper into shreds and threw it back at Han in a swirl of confetti. Han shrugged. I'm sure the police have duplicates.
It doesn't matter.
You know it does, Han snapped. It means your time is up. Your reign as the demon who comes in the night is over. To make matters worse, you have no friends left, no one to help you. That is the life of a Ronin. In the end, you die alone. I'm offering a way out, if you're up to it. But it requires you to bring something to me.
And what might that be? Another head on a platter?
That you'll do for free, Han said. What I need now is information about a missing sword.
Sword?
I assume you've heard of the Hanjo Masamune.
Of course I have, Oni said. It's only the most famous sword in Japan.
So what? It's been missing since the end of World War II. Either the Americans took it or...
Yes, the official story, Han said. I know it well. At the end of the war, the American forces demanded that all weapons, including ceremonial swords, be surrendered. Many of the wealthy were angered by this and fought to keep their swords. But Yamasa Tokugawa believed working with the Americans was the only way to ensure a future for Japan. He turned his collection over. 14 priceless swords, including the Honjo Masamune. They were delivered to a Tokyo police station, where they were later picked up by an American sergeant named Koldi Bymore. They vanished, never to be seen again. An open and shut case, except American records show no evidence of the swords being inventoried, and no record of any soldier, sailor, or airman with that name being stationed in Japan during the entire time of occupation.
Obviously a lie, Oni said.
Of course it's a lie, Han said.
But whose? I have information suggesting something other than American duplicity.
Oni narrowed his gaze.
The hook had been baited. Now Han needed to reel his catch in. Oni wanted to believe. He wanted to see and touch the legendary weapon, to hold it, and even wield it. And why shouldn't he want that? Every artist longed to see the works of the masters. Painters wished to see the brushstrokes of a Picasso or Van Gogh. Sculptors wished to see the David, to touch the marble, though it was off limits. Ushioni had made a life out of weapons and cold steel. To hold the Masamune would be transcendent.
What information?
Records from the Tokugawa family and a secret communique issued to a member of the House of Peers, where Iyamasa Tokugawa served at the end of World War II. They tell a different story.
Go on.
Yamasa Tokugawa did indeed wish to work with the American forces, but others in his family felt differently. They had forgeries made and attempted to replace the priceless swords with the cheap recreations. Tokugawa discovered this at the last minute, and a fight ensued. Several members of his family died struggling against one another. He realized that the swords were not only a point of pride for the family, but a symbol around which Japanese resistance and the idea of a greater Japan might rise again. According to a letter he wrote, Tokugawa both feared and hoped for this, but he'd seen enough death during the Long War and in its aftermath to tip the scales to dread. He decided the swords should be hidden somewhere so they wouldn't become a catalyst for an uprising. He sent word to a member of the House of Peers, and the swords were intercepted. Replicas were handed over in their place, but they didn't fool anyone, and so the story of the American sergeant with the odd-sounding name was fabricated. What happened to the swords? Oni asked. Tokugawa's letter requests that they be given to a Shinto priest and hidden in one of their sanctuaries. Oni looked disgusted. A weapon of war in the hands of a priest. So it seems. Which shrine? Where? There are thousands of them. Han took a deep breath. No mention of the particular shrine was ever made, he admitted. But other letters from the period indicate that the Tokugawa family supported a particular shrine in the footsteps of Mount Fuji, all the way back to a time long prior to the war. A rather obscure sanctuary at that. But if you wanted to hide something priceless, to entrust a national treasure to someone other than yourself, it's only logical to assume you would give it to someone you knew and had a prior existing relationship with. Oni nodded, but there was an aura of distrust about him that never quite left. How is it no one else has uncovered this information? Treasure hunters have been looking for the Honjo Masamune since the day it went missing. I have access to records they cannot see. Han said, government records. You should know that Japanese investigators speculated on this exact possibility as early as 1955, but by then Japan had become utterly dependent on America. He picked up a glass of champagne. Loans from Washington were allowing the country to rebuild. Exports to the United States were growing rapidly, creating a new class of wealthy businessmen, while American ships, planes, and soldiers protected the country from the Russian bear and the Chinese dragon. Considering the situation, those in power decided that nothing would be allowed to damage that relationship, least of all the sudden reappearance of a sword that was linked to Japanese nationalism, the shoguns of old, and the ruling families who'd pushed Japan into war. Nor could they explain its disappearance without implicating the Tokugawa family. So they did what all good politicians do. They buried the information in bureaucratic piles of paper that would reach to the moon, making certain the leads were never investigated, and the truth went dormant. Are you certain of these facts? Oni asked. It's not possible to be certain, Han said. But if the swords are not with the monks, then they are lost forever. But there is also the matter of the journal, believed to belong to Masamune and his descendants. It reveals his secrets, his methods for crafting such masterworks. Oni seemed to accept that, but he remained on guard. You've never shown any interest in collecting. Why would you start now? I'm not here to answer your questions, Han said. But let's just say, I have a sudden interest in the independence of my mother's country, and if you do as I tell you, not only will I grant you wealth, but a new life and a full pardon for your crimes. Now I know you're lying, Oni said. I think I'll just take what you owe me and go. Han shrugged. He was done with the hard sell. He pulled a small disc from his pocket. It was larger than a normal casino chip, made of brass and octagonal in shape. It weighed heavy in the hand and had a number engraved on one side
and the face of a dragon on the other. This marker will cover the balance of payments on your existing contract, he said. Take it to any table. They'll give you high-denomination chips to play with. Or, if you wish, take it directly to the cage. They will pay you in American or European currency, since those bills have larger denominations and are easier to carry. If you change your mind, hold on to the marker and call me. We'll discuss the new deal when you're ready. Han placed the chip on the table beside the window. Oni stepped forward and picked up the golden disc. He felt its heft in his hand as he weighed the options in front of him. He glanced at Han once and then looked out through the glass to the activity below. His feverish eyes widened. No, he whispered. The choice is yours. But Oni was neither listening nor addressing the question of the new contract. He was staring at a figure on the walkway one level below. No, it can't be. He palmed the coin, turned, and stormed toward the door. Han was tempted to grab him, but he knew better than to lay hands on the demon. Oni brushed past, grabbing a wine glass as he went, shattering the bulb against the wall, and then storming out into the hall. Chapter 17 After an hour of studying the layout, Joe was heading back toward the alcove near the front entrance. The pianist had taken a break, and the sounds of a violin solo were filling the room. Finding no sign of Kurt, he accepted another glass of champagne and took a seat in one of the lounge chairs. His back was to the crowd, but he was able to see the reflection of everyone behind him in the polished side of the piano. It was the perfect way to watch the crowd without being seen. He studied each face that passed by, looking for Kurt in the reflection. But it wasn't Kurt that he saw. Instead, he spied a man heading directly for him and carrying something in his hands. Joe knew he'd been made. Normal instincts of fight or flight reared up within him, but he kept calm, waiting as the deranged-looking figure grew closer. At the very last second, Joe dodged to the side and flung the contents of his champagne flute into Ushioni's face. Temporarily blinded, Ushioni's stabbing attempt missed Joe and plunged into the soft back of the chair. But he threw his free arm around Joe's neck, grasping him in a headlock and thrusting the sharpened stem of the wineglass toward Joe's throat. The crowd gasped and pulled back. Joe was at a disadvantage. He had no leverage, but his reactions were flawless. He blocked the stem with his forearm, taking a minor wound in the process and latching onto Oni's wrist. His other hand smashed the champagne glass over the assassin's head, drawing blood and a severe uptick in rage. Oni tore his arm free of Joe's grasp and reared back for another strike, but Joe was quicker. He placed his feet on the side of the grand piano and, instead of pulling away from Oni, pushed toward him with a powerful shove. The peak of the chair hit Oni in the midsection, and he tumbled backward. The chair went over, but Joe sprang to his feet and swung his left foot toward Oni's face, connecting and sending a splatter of blood and saliva flying from the demon's mouth. Oni rolled with the kick and stood up, licking blood off his lips. Joe looked him dead in the eye, extended a hand, and motioned for Ushioni to bring it on. Oni charged, tackling Joe and landing on top of him. Joe heaved him over, reversed their positions, and landed a rabbit punch to Oni's side. The demon once again tried for a sleeper hold, but Joe smashed an elbow into his gut and pulled free. Mission accomplished, Joe thought. He stood, but was taken to the ground by several members of the casino's security detail. They had rushed in from all directions, swarming over both Joe and the demon. Joe couldn't see much through all the arms and legs, but he felt the shock of a taser and the sudden lightness that came with being lifted from the ground by several powerful hands. He and Oni were dragged from the lobby as the onlookers stared and the violinist stood off to one side. The last thing he saw was a man asking her to play and trying to calm the patrons down. and then he was dragged into a back corridor and thrown in a room with concrete walls, a solid floor, and a door made of steel. Ushione was handled in similar fashion by men who had no idea who he was. Despite the fact that his hands were bound, he managed to knee one of them in the gut and send him sprawling to the floor. That earned him a jolt from the taser, which left him stunned and reeling and seething with more anger than before. As he lay there, Oni imagined different ways he would torture them when he got the chance. They searched him for weapons, but found something else instead. The golden chip. Only the casino's most valued guests carried such markers. The rough treatment ended instantly. The guards glanced at one another, and then helped Ushione up off the floor and into a seat. Before they could ask any questions, the door opened. Two men stood there. The first man was named Kashimura. He was the Yakuza underboss who ran the casino. The second was Walter Hahn. Chapter 18. Hideki Kashimura stood in the unadorned room, seething with anger. A broad-shouldered man in his mid-40s, Kashimura ran the club for the syndicate. He collected the money, maintained its veil of secrecy, and enforced its rules mercilessly. Something those foolish enough to cross him usually discovered when they wound up in cement barrels at the bottom of Tokyo Bay. And yet, while violence was second nature to Kashimura, even he felt a certain chill looking into the feverish eyes of Ushione. If half the stories told about the demon were true, it made him the most lethal assassin in Japan. His penchant for toying with his victims first was a kind of sickness even a Yakuza boss disapproved of. Killing was business, not pleasure. But for Ushione, it was both. "I will not tolerate disruption in my club," Kashimura said. "I'm sure our friend Oni had good reason," Han replied. "Your friend," Kashimura corrected. "Oni burned his bridges to the syndicate years ago." "The syndicate," Ushione muttered. He spat blood on the floor to punctuate his disgust. "I should put you in the ring to finish what you started," Kashimura said. "Do it," Oni suggested. Han interrupted. "Who was that man you attacked?" "Don't you recognize him?" Oni said. "He's one of the men you sent me to kill." "What lies are these?" the casino boss asked. "That man is a promoter from Las Vegas." Oni laughed. "He's no promoter. He's an American government agent." "What kind of agent?" Kashimura blurted out. "And why would he come here?" "You have nothing to worry about," Han assured him. "If Oni's correct, it's not the casino they're interested in." "Then what?" "Oni has been recognized. I can only suspect they came here to capture him." "They?" Kashimura said. "You think there are more of them? Would you walk into a fortress like this alone?" Kashimura was furious. He ignored Oni and focused on Han. "You bring this wild man to my place of business and you lose control of him. You let American agents follow you without even warning me to watch out for them. I ought to kill both of you." "Just kill the American and toss him in your koi pond," Oni said. "Better yet, let me do it." "No," Han said. "We have to know if he came alone." "That will be difficult, if not impossible, to determine," Kashimura said. "For obvious reasons, there are no video cameras here." "So torture him, or beat the truth out of him," Ushione said, rising to his feet. Kashimura didn't like the demon being in his establishment. The man was too prone to unnecessary violence, and far too headstrong. "I'm tempted to expel you both," he said. "If the Americans came here looking for you, I can only assume they will leave once you're thrown out, carrying with them whatever information they've picked up on their journey," Han pointed out, "including evidence of who comes here and what they do. Don't think that information won't find its way back to the police." "I'm not worried about the police," Kashimura said proudly. "In the meantime, I'll throw all the foreigners out."
I have a better idea, Han said. Put the American in the ring. Make him fight for his life. Plaster his image on every screen in the establishment. If he came here on his own, you'll get nothing but a thrilling fight. But if he has comrades in the crowd, they will no doubt come to his aid and try to rescue him.